It gives me great pleasure to introduce Peter to speak today. Peter's going to speak on recent developments in procedural and cost aspects of estate litigation. And judging by the audience, I can see a lot of familiar faces, and estate work is an area of work that seems to continue to grow and morph into other things, and it's very interesting. You all probably know Peter. He is, of course, on our list, and he practices in commercial law, equity, trusts, probate, wills, TFM property, and law and superannuation. He has a wide-ranging practice in those areas. Prior to coming to the bar, he was a private secretary to the Commonwealth Attorney General. Probably glad that he's left now. Senior lecturer in the Department of Law at Swinburne University, and he practiced both in chartered accounting and as a solicitor. Would you please welcome Peter?
Thank you, Kate, and good morning. Yes, I was annoyed at having to come and speak to you this morning. I desperately wanted to read the High Court judgment on the Malaysian asylum seeker deal, but I'll find some time later in the day. The matter of this morning's speech is the subject of one of Michael's famous lunches, where he gathers together those who practice in the area and brainstorm, so that we come up with hopefully what you, as our instructing solicitors, would welcome hearing some recent developments about. And so I'm dealing with the procedural and cost aspects, and Anita has got the hot topic of summary dismissals in the TFM jurisdiction. Let me start my paper this morning with, and we're very timely, it's right up to date today, Rod Ratcliffe, formerly the Practice Court Coordinator, is the new Supreme Court Prothonotary. And that might save you from embarrassment if you've got a problem and you were expecting Joe Saldamacchia to pick up the other end of the phone if you wanted to discuss something with him, as practitioners do from time to time. The other aspect that segues into the administration of the court is that, as most of you probably know, from the 1st of July there was a probate list that commenced to operate under the leadership and guidance of Justice Habersberger, and I've appended the probate list practice note to my paper, and the up-to-date aspect of that is that as from tomorrow, the probate list will commence to operate on Fridays and not Thursdays. And you might recall, those of you who practice in the area, that this sort of area has been the subject of some chopping and changing in recent times, because probate business was traditionally the first order of business in the practice court on Thursdays. And then someone had a brilliant idea that it ought to be moved to, I think it was Tuesdays, which of course was always the day that when court number two was under the auspices of, as he was, the late Master Evans, was traditionally a very busy TFM directions hearing day. Common sense prevailed. It was moved back to Thursday in the practice court, but just to keep us on our toes, as from tomorrow, and I'm going to be there, it's on a Friday. So just be mindful of that. The practice note, for those of you that are not familiar with it, essentially says that all probate business other than probate business concerning, say, applications for commission, executor's commission, or Part 4 applications are to be put before that list in the first place for directions. And the probate practice note refers to the matters that in particular would find their way into that list, And as part of that, we see some of those delightfully quaint Latin phrases, grants ad colligendium bona, ad litem or pendonte lite. And that generally causes us to have to look to Osborne to find out now what do those things really mean. For example, the pendonte lite is one pending suit, pending action, and if there's a caveat that is on foot that's holding up an application by originating motion for a grant of probate, well, then in certain circumstances there might be a need for a grant pending the determination of that pending litigation. An ad colligendium bona, for example, is to collect the goods, and is often or sometimes required in this day and age when parties, deceased persons, have practiced as sole proprietors, and there are aspects of their business affairs that need to be quickly attended to before a formal and perhaps more lengthy process of obtaining a grant can be obtained. Just a slight extra comment on that. Given the propensity of people to be structured and to be in companies and to have practice entities and all manner of complexity surrounding their almost individual driving of business operations, you might think, well, are there any such beings still in existence who run businesses by themselves, and if they die there might be need for grants of the kind that I've referred to, ad colligendium bona. That's probably a fair comment if that was in anyone's mind, but just as an example, when the late Peter Brock died, there was an application of this kind in respect of some of his business affairs, and in particular in relating to things concerning sponsorships and intellectual property and branding and the like that all needed attending to very quickly. And they were very valuable aspects of what was otherwise not as perhaps a substantial cash estate as one might have thought, given his prominence and the expected benefits that might come from his role as an identity of a profound kind in motor racing. Anyway, enough of the probate list. Returning to the paper, what we have is a phenomenon that I've described as the rise of the Associate Justice's trial responsibilities. And this has crept up on us, but it's not unexpected. This was a deliberate development in the way in which the courts were structured. And certainly I hadn't taken close note of the details surrounding Associate Justices and their responsibilities. But I did take the opportunity of congratulating Namir Mukhtar when he was appointed an Associate Justice. And I was somewhat surprised, and I expressed it, to have him occupy that position. He was a senior silk and well regarded, and it's often a role that had been filled by someone who hadn't yet taken silk. And he indicated to me that, one of the things that attracted him to the role was the possibility of being referred by the judges of the court trial responsibilities. And as Anita will comment in more detail, he's certainly taken that role on with relish and has caused much consternation in the profession with his decision in Jackson and Nunes back in February of this year, summarily dismissing a nephew's claim for further provision from his late uncle's estate. But when you do the stats and have a look at what's been handed down so far in 2011, we see that there have been seven judgments delivered in the Supreme Court TFM jurisdiction, and six have been brought down by Associate Justices. And Associate Justice Zammit has delivered four judgments. And For those of you who attended her welcome or who know her otherwise from her past professional experience, you'll realise that this wasn't an area that she had practised in prior to taking on that office. Two of her honours decisions, again as Anita will note, relate to the aspect of summary dismissal, and that indicates again how hot a topic this is. What I'm moving on to speak more about is at item four of my paper, where I refer to the fact that three of the seven 2011 TFM judgments have concerned the procedural aspects of an application for an extension of time pursuant to section 99. Now, this is a topic or an aspect of TFM proceedings that that comes and goes. Sometimes we'll see a case and then there won't be an extension of time case some good time in the calendar of unfolding judgments. In many instances, parties who have issued or who seek to have the leave of the court to issue out of time roll up the out of time point and their substantial application into a mediation and settle the matter successfully at mediation. But in the hard cases, the applicants who are out of time are occasionally forced to take the first point and to run it before the court so that there is a separate extension of time application that is brought on and generally hotly contested. The aspects of out of time applications are twofold. The first of them is what we'll call the discretionary aspects. And Kate is very well versed in those, having appeared in Ansett and Moss in the Court of Appeal and in Ashurst and Moss, to which I refer to. But that is very much the subject of the exercise of a discretion having regard to three in particular of the criteria that I've referred to there on the bottom of page two. And the reference in the middle of the page to Dixon J is not to the reincarnation of the late Sir Owen, but is John Dixon, relatively recently appointed to the Supreme Court, and he heard one of the applications in McCann and Ward. And it's also been the subject of a number of other single-judge applications before Justices Robson and Cairo, and the like that are referred to in the footnote five on the bottom of page two. But essentially, those sort of discretionary aspects are, does the plaintiff have an arguable case? This, with a slight refinement, is something that comes up again in the context of the summary dismissal matters that Anita will speak about. Second aspect is there any prejudice to the beneficiaries if time is extended? And the third, which I've listed at the top of page three, is what's the period of the delay and any explanation for it? And I think in Kate's cases, the period of delay was 23 years, an exceptionally long period. When you get down, and I've deliberately listed that as the third point, the period of delay and any explanation for it, because the court will ordinarily take such matters into account, but there are no rigid rules in relation to this, and certainly Justice Gillard, when he was on the bench, was very much of the view that, look, if the plaintiff has a strongly arguable case and there's no prejudice, then you really don't give very much weight to any explanation for delay or the time that's involved. They're just mere facts in the wider panorama of facts coming before the court. Moving on from those, what I'll call discretionary aspects of extension of time, the more troublesome conceptual aspect of an out-of-time application relates to the question as to whether or not the estate has been fully distributed. And we always need to start any discussion of that particular topic with a quick review of the High Court's decision in Easterbrook and Young. And part of the headnote summarises it quite conveniently, where the High Court is said by the writer of the headnote to have determined that case on the basis of the principle that only the complete removal of the whole of the assets of the deceased from the hands or name of the personal representative will be a bar to an extension of time. And I've bolded those parts of the headnote to give them emphasis. Now, there will be a complete removal, obviously, if there's physical delivery of assets or if there's actual payment, or if, for example, with real property, there's been a signing and a lodging with the Titles Office of registered applications for transfer. But when none of those simple facts have occurred, we are in something of a conundrum. The courts say that the mere fact that the administration has been complete and the role of the executors has transmogrified into the role of trustees is only one factor. So you can't sort of lay too much focus on that change in status and role. It's one factor only to be taken into account. And you're then forced to delve deeper into the factual scenario, the facts in evidence, to see whether or not there has been, as the High Court said, that complete removal of the whole of the assets from the executors. In Ashurst and Moss, in which Kate appeared, there were two aspects of the late Sir Reginald Ansett's estate that were said to be immune from application for provision, and one was the Ashurst Settled Fund, and the other one was the common fund that was described as the R.M. Ansett Trust. But other aspects of the asset pool were free to be subject to attack from the Part 4 applications. Now, the Ashurst Settled Fund, Jane Ashurst being one of the late Sir Reginald Ansett's daughters, was to be held the net annual income upon protective trust for Jane for life and upon her death for her children and upon the death of any child on the trust declared for the residue, and they related to a couple of the local schools down there in Mount Eliza, Toorak College and Peninsula, and there were other charitable potential objects. The decision of Justice Hanson in that case was that those particular, the Ashurst Settled Fund and the R.M. Ansett Trust, were immune from attack under the Part 4 application. There was a final distribution in respect of those two matters. And I footnoted in footnote 10 a particular aspect of His Honour's judgment, where he distinguished public trustee and kid, and spoke about the particular aspect of the trust, particularly the Ashurst Settled Trust, that caused him to decide as he did. And essentially it was that there was a succession involved. There were successive interests. There were successive life interests from Jane Ashurst to her children and then the residue. And with 23 years of operation, those aspects were said to be determinative of a final distribution. Moving quickly to Justice Gillard in Grosser and Equity Trustees, His Honour adopted what's conveniently referred to as a robust approach to this issue, and at the top of page 6 said that the fact that the personal representative holds any assets still in its hands on trust for a beneficiary or next of kin does not amount to a final distribution of the estate within the meaning of section 99. Now, that's, as I said, within those who deal with these matters, thought of as a very robust statement. But in Associate Justice Zammit's case, which I'll go to in Gilchrist and Equity Trustees, Richard Bowden, who was counsel for Equity Trustees in that latter case, referring back to Grosser, said to Her Honour that that was a case that was correctly decided. And I note that that part of Gilchrist's case in footnote 11 on page 5 of my paper. But with time as it is, I'll continue to move on and simply return to this most recent decision of Her Honour in Gilchrist and Equity Trustees. And here we've even extended a decade beyond Kate's 23 years because we had an application for an extension of time that was 33 and a half years after the expiry of the 6 months from the date of the grant of probate. And the application failed on the basis that there had been a full distribution, a final distribution of the estate. Alternatively, Her Honour said, look, if I'm wrong, because she was mindful of the fact that this is a troublesome area, that she said that it wouldn't be granted having regard to or exercising her discretion pursuant to section 99 of the Act. And what you had briefly in Gilchrist's case was that the plaintiff had a life interest in two of five parts of a net residuary estate, the remainder to his children on their attaining 21. The plaintiff at a later date had another inheritance. He'd inherited a property in Victoria Road, Hawthorne, and in 1984, in about the middle of that year, he requested the trustees to purchase from him that particular property. And they acceded to his request and did so. And so his interest in the estate, which was a little bit over $57,000, was credited to a settled fund, as it was described. And from that, the purchase price of $54,000 was applied and debited against it. And that was reflective of the purchase by Equity from him of the Victoria Road property. And he then lived in that pursuant to a right of occupancy for life. The balance, less a valuation fee for the Hawthorne Road property, was invested in the common fund administered by Equity. And at the same time, his sister, the co-beneficiary, her estate was credited to her part of the estate was credited to her settled fund. And it was a finding in the case that the estate account was closed on a particular date. Now, in those circumstances, Her Honour found this was no mere transmission of an executor's role into a trustee's role. There were concrete steps that had been taken that caused her to decide that in the circumstances of the case, there was a complete removal of the whole of the assets from the name of the personal representative in accordance with the requirements of the High Court in Easterbrook. Now, just very quickly, I have made mention there of judicial mediations moving on by the Associate Justices. You can see they are persons with very heavy responsibilities, which they discharge admirably. But part of those responsibilities include the judicial mediations that most of us will have had some contact with from time to time. There are 3 to 4 months delay in getting some Associate Justice to be available. And being in court on Tuesday, last the traditional directions hearing day for TFM applications that Associate Justice Efton has taken over, I noted when I'd looked at the court list the night before that he was running a mediation on that date, and it had started before he came to court at 10:30, and he deals with them very expeditiously, and he was going back to attack the mediation. So a very hard-working role. And as I note, and as you'd be very familiar with you, Supreme Court judges don't act as judicial mediators, and that raises all sorts of nice conceptual matters. The county court's TFM jurisdiction I'll simply leave at this stage, other than to note that an aspect that has caused some of my fellow practitioners some concern is the fact that in approvals of compromise by minors, none of the traditional approach by the Supreme Court Associate Justices and prior to that Masters is adopted. The hearing is not necessarily ex parte. There is no written advice of counsel for the court to consider. It's all done very informally and in open court. and that reflects the well-known approach of Justice Missow to deal with matters expeditiously through case conferencing where possible, and if all else fails, to put a hearing on at the first available date. The last matter that I want to refer to this morning is costs in TFM proceedings. There really has been a cat set amongst the pigeons by Associate Justice Gardner in his decision in Ree Khan, and certainly the scuttle about the case has rippled through the profession. But before I say any more about that, let me just simply say that this is not the first time that there has been an adverse cost decision in Victorian TFM proceedings, but there have not been many of them. And when you try and track them down, reviewing either the standard services or internet searches, you can't find many actual decided cases in Victoria where TFM unsuccessful plaintiffs have copped a cost order. For example, I looked and tried to determine whether or not Justice Harper had made an adverse costs order against the unsuccessful plaintiff in the case of Schmidt and Watkins. In that case, you might recall, His Honour had determined that there was no de facto relationship between the applicant and the deceased. There was a long-standing business relationship, but it wasn't the sort of close personal relationship that caused His Honour to, or would cause His Honour to say that there was a responsibility owed by the deceased to the applicant. So it was an unsuccessful plaintiff, but there was certainly no later costs hearing where there was an adverse cost decision. The services do record an adverse cost decision back in 2003 in the case of Gapes, where Justice Nathan, as he then was when he was on the bench, made a cost order against an unsuccessful plaintiff who was a daughter of the deceased who took action against her siblings. The deceased mother had made a totally orthodox will where she devised and gave everything to her children equally. But this particular plaintiff was unhappy with that outcome, challenged it, and was singularly unsuccessful before His Honour. And he determined that she should bear the costs of her failed application out of her share of the estate. So she had a third of the estate locked in, and she wanted more. Summarising it, it was a view that His Honour took that she was motivated by greed, and she copped a pretty substantial rap on the knuckles. But she did have a pot, so to speak, from which the costs order could be applied against, namely her own share of the estate. For those of you who are interested in this aspect of costs of unsuccessful plaintiffs, and plenty of you will be who act for either potential plaintiffs or executors, I recommend that you have a look at Justice Byrne, as he was when he was on the bench, decision in the case of Bentley and Brennan. Now, Bentley and Brennan, that's number two. The citation is 2006 VSC 226. I haven't put it in the paper because I simply ran out of time. Luke was pressing Anita and I to have our papers in hand so that he could print them out available for you this morning. But His Honour, as he always did, gave a very well-reasoned decision in that case. You might recall it was a very controversial case because the deceased had engaged in criminal sexually exploitive conduct in relation to the plaintiff when the plaintiff had been a much younger man. And despite that fact, there had been relationship of many years between them. The plaintiff failed in that case, and Justice Byrne was at pains to say to the profession and to the plaintiff this jurisdiction was not a case or was not a jurisdiction where compensation was awarded for wrongs. It was a jurisdiction that required responsibility. The responsibility was one to be decided in accordance with community standards, and in his view, the judgment of a wise and just testator in the current community standard application would not give rise to a responsibility. But what His Honour did in part when he made a costs order against the unsuccessful, and I'll, sorry, refrain from that for a moment, His Honour looked at the background to the two costs provisions in the legislation, 97.6 and 97.7. And 97.6 is just the reference to costs being, as the court decides, is just. And 97.6 is the frivolous, vexatious and no reasonable prospects of success test. And what His Honour did was reminded us that when this particular change to our wills and estate area came into existence in 1998, it was very much a clear choice on the part of the government to go to the wider concept of responsibility as being the touchstone for any award of provision or further provision. They did not seek, and quite deliberately did not seek, to restrict it to the previous areas, which essentially were widows, widowers and children, and looking at it in a broader sense, quite different from the approach that's recently been taken in New South Wales, where again they've restricted it to defined categories of family members or those who can get leave based on a close personal relationship. And so what His Honour said from there is that such a change, when you've got this aspect of responsibility, it creates a situation of some uncertainty. Will the plaintiff fit within a category of persons to whom the deceased owed a responsibility, or won't they? It is not quite as straightforward as defining the categories by reference to status of marriage or de facto partners or someone who has a close personal relationship with that particular phrase might be attempted to be defined or the subject of court deliberation. And so His Honour was very taken by the fact that this was something that can give rise to uncertainty. And for that reason, he said, although it was accepted that it was the plaintiff was unsuccessful and he didn't fall within the class of applications, he's got to make an order that seemed just. And in the particular circumstances of the case, he said that the plaintiff ought not be required to bear the costs of the estate, but he had to bear his own costs. Now, and very quickly, in Reid Khan, what Associate Justice Gardiner did was to change his mind in a magnificent reversal, because what he'd done was to decide the case, and at the end of it, as I've noted there at the bottom of page 9, to say that I'll hear the parties on the question of costs, but although Peter, the brother, has not been successful, he went on to say that subject to submissions of the parties, I consider that the costs of this unfortunate proceeding should be paid by the estate. Now, having led with his chin, then the matter was returned and submissions, both in writing and orally, were made, which were the subject of the number 2 case, which I refer to at the top of page 10. And I've given lengthy extracts from His Honour's decision in that case, because they do pay a close reading. And essentially, what His Honour found in that case, this wasn't a borderline or at the margin case. He believed that it was a case that didn't have reasonable prospects of success. And he said a just outcome anyway, that is employing both 97.6 and 97.7, was that the unsuccessful plaintiff should bear the estate's costs and his own. And it's a salutary reminder, therefore, of the risks that that might be attendant upon an application. And very briefly, in those in that particular case, Peter Murth was a brother who had net assets of approximately $1 million. His brother was far less well off, and his brother had been left a life interest in the deceased mother's home, which was the only substantial asset of the estate. And he had to be accommodated, and basically what His Honour Associate Justice Gardiner said was that in that situation, Peter Murth ought not to have brought an application when the only real result of it would have been to have entirely sort of crowded out. He could only be successful if he was going to crowd out his brother, who had a well-recognised need for accommodation. And as I said, came down fairly heavily in terms of the final order. In part noted that in Victoria, the approaches were, on the one hand, different from South Australia, and South Australia in turn was different from New South Wales. So have a look at those particular aspects of the judgment as I've placed them there, and take suitable advice if you're in any doubt as to possibly adverse cost consequences of taking on a Part 4 claim. All right, time's against me. Thank you.